Today we're going to be talking about Ephesians 3 and 4. And we're just a little behind, of course, because of the snow days. Mrs. Bettina and I were talking about the forecast for this weekend of more continued snow. There was an email, I want to say about a week and a half ago, that I sent to Mrs. Cummings, you know, is the white witch sabotaging our Bible study? So, it's always winter and never Christmas. That's why I think this is always the toughest part of the year. When it's getting up to December, it can be unpleasant, but you can say eggnog, presents, you know, family, whatnot. It's like you get to this part of the year and it's unpleasant and you think, Lent. The weather's already bad and now I'm giving things up. So, great, it'll be Easter. We'll have some eggs and bunnies. That'll do it. That'll make me feel better. One of the things I thought I should start with, you know, last time we were talking about the responsibilities or oversight that the angels have over creation. And again, we're very used to hearing about the angels in terms of revealing, you know, God's word or God's plan. We're very familiar with angels sort of assisting us in our lives. But the role of angels in the universe, that's something that I think for some number of you is kind of startling to hear. And, you know, this is one of the things when I think about this. I mean, how do I know this? I know this because I went to a Catholic college that had 4 years of theology, and we had 2 years of St. Thomas. And I just think that just speaking generally, you know, that's what Catholic higher education should do. There are all sorts of things that we can address, you know, with your children when they're freshmen, sophomores, juniors, seniors in high school. There are all sorts of good things they can get that, you know, they go off to college and they meet all sorts of kids who they went to Catholic school and they just didn't get any of it. You know, it's like a lot of these kids just get cheated. They could have C.S. Lewis. They could have St. Augustine. They could have those things. But even then, there's just only so much you can do with 15, 16, 17, 18-year-olds. There's just, you know, you hit a ceiling at a certain point. There are certain things they are able to understand at that point in their lives. And they're able, this is what I'm saying, they're able to get a lot more than I think a lot of other high schools give credit. They really are able to tackle some of these bigger questions in a way that a lot of other schools sell them short. But you do hit a ceiling. There are things that you just need the maturity of being 19, 20, 21, 22 for that to take in. You can't just scale it, do it early. You can't. You've got to be older, more mature. And there are some of these kind of big questions about the cosmos, about science, some of the things with regard to divine providence or good and evil, or harder questions about how you come to know things. You can't do that in high school. That really is college level stuff. And unfortunately, I think a lot of our Catholic colleges, they don't immerse their Catholic students in St. Thomas. They don't immerse them in St. Augustine. They don't immerse them in these sources. And, you know, I feel bad because, in a way, I think of, you know, there's a certain preparation you get here. And I just want for every student that they could go off to college and that would get deeper. You know what I mean? They wouldn't be just like hearing the same things over again. No, they've been formed a certain way and now they could just continue to go deeper in it. And it's so disappointing when you talk to your graduates and they come back and they tell you things like, I took theology classes, but it was like, where's the beef? You know, you remember the old Emma Peller, you know, from Wendy's. Where's the beef? And they're fluffy, they're light, they're political, they're heretical. You know, theology at that college level should allow you to go deeper in these things. So some of these things I'm telling you about the angels, I know it because I had it sophomore and junior year in college. You know, I certainly didn't have it in high school, and I doubt if I would have tracked very well with it in high school. But these are things that's where that needs to happen. And so I think for many of us as Catholics, again, even those of us who went to Catholic schools or Catholic universities, you know, it may be that that wasn't there. You know, that just wasn't there. And maybe you got some old Jesuit who, you know, who gave it to you at some point, or some old Dominican who was still holding on to this. But generally, for many of us, you know, the only reason I had it is because I went to this very unusual college where it was founded by people who were just exasperated with the direction of Catholic universities and Catholic colleges. And they left those colleges mid-career. Something that just was you would, as a career move, you just think would be crazy. These guys were like 40 years old, 35, 40 years old, kind of in, you should be where you belong and settle down. They left Santa Clara University and St. Mary's and Moraga and some of these places, and they started Thomas Aquinas College. You know, on paper, that just looked reckless. But they did it because they wanted to be able to give students an immersion in something that in these institutions they were at was gone, was just dying or gone. Sir Davis, do you have your hand up? Oh, I think St. Thomas in Houston is like this. I think it has to some degree. There are programs at Boston College and Notre Dame, but it's kind of a minefield. So you have to, and when you step on the mine, it goes boom. But there are, but you know, the people who taught me are dead. I mean, these Thomists who taught me when I was in college, literally, I mean, they're dead. You know, and I don't know that they were, you know, replaced. I mean, but there are places that are out there, and sometimes you find it. Sometimes it's the literature professor who, because he was interested in Dante, got interested in St. Thomas. You know, sometimes it's the history professor who, because he got interested in the Middle Ages, he got drawn into Augustine. So sometimes it's in places that you wouldn't expect it to be. Some of the things I'm gonna talk about today, some of the things that I talked about in the past with the Old Testament, I got from a fellow named Arthur Quinn, who was in the rhetoric department at the University of California, Berkeley. But he would talk about the rhetorical dimension of things like the Gospels or the Book of Kings or Samuel or Judges. And what he taught was really drilled down into not just the language and the grammar and so on, but the supernatural character of the book. You know, yeah, so you find these things sometimes in surprising places. But again, the point I'm making is there are these things in theology and in our tradition which, you know, some of that you can do at the high school level, and that's what we try to give your children. But some of it really is college stuff. You can't just take everything from college, and there are all sorts of, you know, fine secular schools out there who do amazing things. But, you know, in terms of this sort of thing, there's no substitute for having a college theology class that's orthodox and from the tradition. There's just no substitute for it. You can't just throw it on DVDs or do it online. You have to be held down in it as a 21-year-old. So the reason that had come up was we're seeing it here in chapter 3, both in verse 2, where it talks about the economy of God's grace, and that word again, economy, is used again in verse 9. The economy of the mystery hidden from ages in God. Okay, remember that word economy in the letter to the Ephesians, the management of the universe, the management of the universe according to some kind of long-term plan. And we talked about that management last time with regard to the angels, that the angels not only see things like revelation, but even in some degree oversee the natural development of the universe. Now, this line here, the mystery hidden from ages in God, again, you might have the sense, I'm going to speak a little further about something that I mentioned briefly last time, you might have the sense that since God's this great spirit and the angels are all spirits, it's like they all know the same things. Like once you get into the spiritual realm, it's like everybody knows everyone and everybody knows what's happening. And the claim here is that that God would not only give man certain gifts and blessings and guidance, but that he would take on human nature, that he would come to earth, unite himself to the human race in Christ Jesus. This was a mystery hidden from ages in God. Okay? So in other words, if you think that angels just know this because they... No, angels have a natural knowledge that they have as angels, but angels also have revelation. There are things that are revealed to them above and beyond what it is they know as angels. So to be an angel means that there are certain things that you know just as part of your nature, and they're infused. They're infused. They're just part of what you are as an angel. So for us, we come into the world, and we come into the world with empty heads. We haven't an idea upstairs at all. And you've got to sense and experience and learn in order to get ideas up there. And it's a very long and slow process, as probably you've seen with your own children. Oh, those of you who are there out of the house now, you talk about how fast it goes. Remember back to when, like, they were younger and you didn't feel it was so fast? It takes forever for them to seemingly get down anything. Knowledge is a very, very difficult and a very, very slow process. Knowledge is not you memorize something for the test and you dump it back and give it back. That's not knowledge. Knowledge are the things that you're holding on to long term. You know, mere memorization is not, of course, knowledge. Knowledge is that kind of long-term holding on to things. Okay, so obviously our condition is a very difficult one because the long-term things take a very long time to get in. For an angel is created with its mind full of ideas. Okay, so there are certain things about themselves, about the world, about God, that they understand just through their creation, just by being angels. But now if you're talking about God's will or God's plan, you are talking about things that are inside the divine nature, that are inside the divine persons. So that's not something that the angels just look at, oh, I know what they're going to do next. No, it isn't like that at all. God has to reveal to them what his plan is, where this is all going, what he's up to. So just like human beings have things that they know naturally, but then there are things that have to be revealed to them. So also with angels. There are things that angels know naturally, but then there are also things that have to be revealed to them. Okay? This goes to the basic point that angels are not, if you like, naturally in heaven. They are not naturally in the presence of God. Okay? They understand and know God better than, of course, we do naturally. But to have their angelic mind with a kind of direct apprehension of God as he is in himself? No. They don't have that by nature. No being has that by nature. No created mind has that by nature. If you are apprehending the vision of God, it is because God has given it to you. Okay? No being, even the highest angel, has that naturally. Okay? Go ahead. Of course it does. Because otherwise, what sense would it make for Satan and the devils to be enjoying the divine vision and just, nah, this isn't for me? That's impossible, right? Enjoying the divine vision is the supernatural perfection of any kind of created mind. So when you picture the angels falling, you have to think of angels who are being offered that vision. They don't have it. They're being offered that vision. But there's something about the terms, in terms of how it was offered or what it involved, that evidently some number of these angels said, no. No. When you read St. Augustine in City of God, he will talk about how it is that, you know, God is the most universal common good of the universe. Okay? He's the good of all of his beings. He's their good in various ways. Obviously, he's the good of a tree, different from the ways he's our good. But he's the good of all beings. He's the universal good. But what must have happened with the angels, or with the fallen angels, is that they looked upon that common good but they wanted it as a kind of private good of their own. In other words, they wanted that good in a disordered way. So you can have somebody look at the common good of the community, say the common good of Maple Grove or Plymouth or something, and say, wow, this is great that people are living in peace and harmony and prosperity. You can have people look at the common good and say, yeah, this is great that people are living this way. What can I get out of it? How can this good serve me? Okay? That, in other words, is a kind of a selfish appropriation of the common good. They look at the common good as a means for their own. So an easy way that students can get quickly, because they don't think about things like community, they don't think about things like Maple Grove and so on. Say, picture a family where everybody in the family is only thinking about the other people in the family as a means for their own good. Okay? Mom's going to take me to practice. Dad's going to give me money. Sister's going to, you know, introduce me to some of her pretty friends. You know, you look at everybody as a means. And I said, now, in the psychological world, we have a term for that. That's what we call dysfunctional. That's what a dysfunctional family is, where each of the members looks upon the other as a means for their own. Okay? So when you think about when Tolstoy says, all happy families resemble one another, but all unhappy families are unhappy in their own peculiar way. The way that all happy families resemble one another is that each of the members finds their good in the good of the whole. That they recognize that their happiness is bound up with the happiness of everybody in that family. That the happiness of others is not merely a means for their own happiness, but that their happiness is somehow completed by the happiness of the other people in that family. That's what a happy family looks like. So when St. Paul is talking about this divine plan, and that God is going to make this supernatural good, which he made available to the angels, now through the incarnation, available to human beings, there's a kind of a great, a great elevation of human dignity. I harp on this point because there's a way in which the apostles are being told things that the angels themselves did not know. That in Christ Jesus, the apostles are spreading a plan that the angels are only finding out about. Okay? That is a great elevation of human dignity. It's a great elevation of human dignity that, as he goes on to say, there are apostles, there are prophets. In other words, God works through human beings. We don't appreciate that sometimes because, again, we just think about results. Why can't God, in fact, I had this as a question just this morning. Why can't God work more miracles so more people would believe? Why doesn't your mother ride behind you on your bicycle so that you make sure you don't fall over when you're a little kid? She'll just be right there with you the whole time. How are you ever going to learn to ride the bike? Is that what you're going to do when all the other kids are riding their bikes? There's mom holding on to you. Or mom covers you with bubble wrap so that you, oh, I'm just worried you're going to scrape your knees. Here, have another layer of bubble wrap. Your maturation as a young bike rider is that she's not going to be walking next to you, jogging next to you, covering you with bubble wrap. You're going to be able to do this on your own. It is an elevation of human dignity that God is not just miraculously appearing to everybody, but that he founds a church. He founds a church of human beings. And that those human beings carry God, carry the gospel, carry the message to others. One of the terms that you see here, the fatherhood of God, by whom all fatherhood is named, that somehow the divine paternity is the source of all paternity. Now you can look at that and think, well, but what happens in God is so different from us. What would that mean? He's purely spiritual, we're physical, we're animal. What does it mean when St. Paul says that? Well, if you think about Our Lady, remember the amazing thing is that we have a woman who is a mother without a human father. Right? Without a human father. But in a way, that's a kind of an inverse of what it is that you have in the Trinity. That you have fatherhood without motherhood. That you have a father who conceives a son without there being a womb or gestation or any of those things. There is, if you like, almost a kind of a perfection of fatherhood. That for a human father, we are always contributing to bringing another being. He's the same in species. He's human, but you know, it's a different. But it's in different matter over there. So I'm humanity here, and my son is humanity there. You know, we're the same kind of thing. But in God, you have this perfection of generation because it's the same being. They are both God. They're not the same kind of being. They are both God. They are both in the divine nature, in other words. Okay? So you have this perfection of fatherhood that without a mother, without a womb, that a son comes to be, that comes to be as the same being as the father. Right? This is very high, very, very elevated stuff. But there's a perfection of fatherhood in God. Sometimes I wish on Father's Day, periodically you'll hear something like that, you know, God the Father. And it's precisely the thing that the more nervous that we get about sexual differences, you know, the beauty of the whole teaching gets lost or diminished or embarrassed. Remember, for years there was a parish in the Twin Cities. Again, I'll conceal the name to protect the guilty, but they were baptizing people in the name of the Creator, the Redeemer, and the Sanctifier. They're doing that for 20 years, and of course that's totally invalid. You've got to, I wouldn't say rebaptize because they weren't baptized. You've got to baptize people who've been baptized with that formula. But the reason that people were drawn to that is because it was gender neutral. When you say Creator, Redeemer, Sanctifier, you don't have the baggage of father and son. Okay? But the reason that you talk about the father being a father is because of the kind of generation that's going on. It's not material. There's no womb. There's no gestation. You wouldn't just call it parenthood. It's not that general. And it's important that Mary is a mother. You know, not, again, just like a parent, that she really does bring that human dimension of parenting that involves a womb, a gestation. In fact, her womb is, blessed is the fruit of your womb. Okay? In fact, in a lot of the prayers, in the Little Loss of the Blessed Virgin, the womb of Mary is compared to the Holy of Holies. It's talked about like it's a tabernacle. Okay? So that human, that motherly dimension. Remember that. And it's not, in a way, it's not just true of the incarnation, that you know, when mother and father come together to conceive a child, they are not the sole causes for the existence of that child. So that you have sperm, you have egg, neither one of those are rational, neither one of them are intelligent, and somehow they come together and make something that's rational and intelligent. No. God infuses a rational soul into what it is that mother and father contribute. So it's not an exaggeration to say that every time a human child is conceived, something miraculous happens. So we may talk about the miracle of life or the miracle of human life, but really we feel as though we're saying something metaphoric. Oh, of course, there's something all natural going on. No. That is literally a miracle. It is literally supernatural, that what you have happening in the womb is the infusion of something that is supernatural into what it is that the man and woman contribute. So that's why, again, to talk about the mother's womb, the human mother's womb, as this very special place, this exalted place, in a way, it's not just true of the incarnation. So the fatherhood of God, that you're able to have this kind of conception without that maternal process, you know, that is a kind of perfection, and that's why the fatherhood of God is in some ways an image of what fatherhood is down here. But he has these traits or these qualities that, of course, human fathers are not able to have. As we go into chapter 4, one of the things that this is where he begins to talk about the church, as it were, on the level that we see. A lot of this is describing the church in this supernatural or invisible dimension. Maybe if you had older forms of catechesis, they would talk about the church triumphant and the church suffering and the church militant. That would be the language that you would hear. A lot of times when we talk about the church, we think about it institutionally. In other words, bishops, priests, deacons, administration, ministries, offices. We that tends to be our picture. And it's not as if that picture doesn't matter. I mean, it isn't an incarnational church. It's going to have these physical expressions. But you never want to lose the cosmic sense of the church, that this is a church that extends beyond the three dimensions of reality that we're used to. That's why I think chapters 2 and chapters 3 are so important. Before he goes into these human elements, he's giving you these kind of cosmic elements of the church, to think of a church that extends beyond the visible world, that extends beyond the visible and experiential world. It can be a very elevating thing, a very edifying thing, that, let's say, you grew up in rural Wisconsin, you grew up in this Polish Catholic community, you went to St. Casimir's Parish, and your parents grew up in St. Casimir's, and so you have this picture of the Catholic Church that's pretty Polish, and maybe you get a little exotic, you drive up to Warsaw, and you go to the German Catholic Parish up there, St. Adalbert's or whatnot. Oh, okay, I'm getting a wider view of the church now. You still got this kind of American Midwestern slice of Catholicism. And that, you hop in a plane, and you experience a liturgy, maybe in Ghana, or Nigeria, or the Philippines, or South Korea. And you realize, this really is a universal church. This really is a universal church. This isn't just a church of us kind of aging Europeans, or Midwestern Europeans or whatnot. This is really a universal church. Now, somehow, if you could, like, wrinkle in time style, tesseract into these other dimensions of, of purgatory or whatnot, and, that you would see that it's not just an international church, that it's a cosmic church, that it exceeds the dimensions, again, of what it is that we can see and experience. So in chapter 4, it's the best place to start. Where he's talking about Christ, it is said, I'm at verse 8. It is said, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives, he gave gifts to men. In saying he ascended, what does it mean? But he also descended to the lower parts of the earth. He who descended is he who also ascended far above the heavens, that he might fill all things. And his gifts were that some should be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors, teachers, to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for the building up of the body of Christ. Okay. So the idea there is that when you have, again, like a family, that each person in that family has a kind of a role, a position, a contribution. The idea of society is not that everybody is equal or the same. The idea of a happy society, in fact, is that there is inequality and difference. If you have a choir, how interesting is it to listen to if everybody's singing the same note? Right? What you want is people singing singing different and related notes that give you all sorts of layering and all sorts of coloring, all sorts of contrast. So, there can be this emphasis in our society that where you have differences, and especially where those differences imply inequality, there's just something unfair about that. There's just something wrong about that. That's just occasion for envy and resentment. But the problem is, when you look at the universe into which we find ourselves, if there's anything that's clear about the universe from this, or anything that's clear about God from the universe we live in, it's that this God loves inequality, because it's everywhere. It's not just the inequality of, like, plants, animals, human beings, right? And then plants among themselves and animals among themselves and so on. But even for human beings, you know, that, you know, there are differences in terms of intelligence. There are differences in terms of physical skill. There are differences in social skills. When you think about different cultures out there, you know, the Greeks were great at coming up with philosophy and ideas and artistic beauty. And the Romans, they were great at engineering and law. You know, each of these different cultures had something that it excelled at. And they, you know, so when we talk about Western civilization, in a way we're talking about an accumulation of different products that these various cultures have given to us. You know, what's great is to be able to not just have that kind of philosophic or artistic side that the Greeks had, or the law and engineering that Romans had, but to be able to somehow benefit from both, and even to be able to benefit from them all. Okay? So when St. Paul talks about the unity of the body and the diversity of gifts, for us, our tendency is to think that diversity acts against unity. That if we have these differences, especially, again, insofar as those differences imply some kind of inequality, like, I've got something you don't, we think that that's a problem. That creates a social instability. When, in fact, it's exactly the opposite. If we were all equal and we all had the same things, we're associating again together because why? But if you are able to sing, and I can't carry a tune in a basket, but I sure enjoy music, we are brought together. You know, some of these students who are very good at math, you can see them, you know, trying to learn from the kids who are good at math, and it could be they're good at history, and now they try to help the kids who aren't good at history. They are brought together because of their mutual needs, because of those mutual differences. Okay, you can have. I remember my friends of mine who followed basketball back in the 90s, and they were talking to me. They were explaining to me how it is that the Bulls were not a championship team when Jordan was actually scoring the highest. It was once you had more members on the team scoring more, and Jordan's numbers were actually going down, that's when they were winning. You know, if you just have a team where there are like a couple of stars, usually that isn't going to work. It's because there are many people who have different gifts that they complement. They fill out each other. Okay? So difference is not a difference, and in fact, especially where that difference implies inequality, that should not be something that just creates envy and resentment for us. You know, the church itself is meant to be this society that thrives on those differences, where those differences, again, fill out and complement each other. Complement each other, fill out what's missing. Okay? And that there are people to whom God gives prophecy or ministry or teaching or caring for the poor or whatnot. That doesn't mean that everybody is called to all those things. He gives that diversity of gifts precisely so that we can all help each other out and, again, act as one body. You all remember from Corinthians where St. Paul will push that image of the body and say, you know, should the eye say to the foot, hey, you're not an eye, you know, should the foot say to the eye, right? We don't want a body that's somehow all eye or all foot. Pretty disturbing once you think about it. We want a body that has a diversity of organs that are somehow all functioning together. I have to say something about verse 24. Indue me domine is how it goes in Latin. Let's see if I have my... I have to go to my window here. Here we go, verse 24.
Chapter 4, yes. Yeah, wait a minute, this isn't right. Oh, that's why. So if you look in, the English, verse 24, this is where St. Paul, sorry, verse 23, there must be a renewal in the inner life of your minds. You must be clothed in a new self, which is created in God's image, justified and sanctified through the truth. So in Latin, Induitem novem hominem, qui secundum Deum creatus est justitia et sanctitate veritatis. That prayer we had written down outside the sacristy when I served in college. And this very commonly, for altar boys, is the vesting prayer. So you say this as you're putting on your cassock and your alb. This is what you're saying as you put those things on. And I don't know, I'm making a mental note to myself. Does my son serves as an altar boy, but I don't think they have this prayer up. So I'm gonna have to speak, my daughters are the artistic ones. Have to put up a little thing, we can laminate it, put it in there. But it you say this verse because it's helping you understand what putting on this garb is all about. You're serving at the altar, and in some way you're participating in something that is supposed to renew you from the inside. Newman has something really helpful on this. In fact, he takes this particular passage, and he talks about how it is that, that you put on the new man, which after God is created in righteousness and holiness. These words express very strongly a doctrine which is to be found in every part of the New Testament, that the gospel covenant is the means of introducing us into a state of life so different from that in which we were born and should otherwise continue that it may not unfitly be called a new creation. Okay? So, as I was saying earlier, we can talk about the conception of a human child and think of that as a miracle metaphorically, when in fact what's happening in a woman's womb is like God taking the mud of the earth and breathing into it and saying, right, you are human, breathing and making it into a living soul, to use the language of Genesis. Likewise, we can think of baptism, and we can think of the entrance into the Christian life as sort of being a new creature metaphorically. Like it's like being something new, or it's like being created again. No, it's not metaphoric. It's not metaphoric. When you are given a life of grace, you are having something supernatural put into you, which is elevating your human life. So maybe a way to think about it, just like, let's say, in Narnia, where Aslan breathes on the animals and makes them talking animals, right? He has put something supernatural. You wouldn't say that that's metaphorically that they're a new creature. No, if you're a beaver or a horse that can talk, in a way, you are a new creature. To be a talking beast or a talking animal is to be a new creature. That gap is not as radical as the gap between being a human being and now a human being with a baptized life infused with sanctifying grace. That by the infusion of sanctifying grace, your natural powers are elevated above where they would be at naturally. What do I mean by that? That by faith, and even by forms of infused knowledge, you are able to know and understand things that naturally you would not be able to know and understand. That by the infused virtue of hope, you are able to hope for spiritual and supernatural goods that by your natural powers you would not be able to do. And that most importantly, by the infusion of charity, you are able to love God in a way that naturally you are not able to love God. Okay? That the belief in God, the hope in God, the love of God, because of our experience, we think of those things as just the result of human causes. So in other words, I'm able to believe or hope or love because my parents raised me this way, or because I grew up as an Irish Catholic, or because I grew up as a Minnesota Lutheran, or, you know, it's because of some kind of human cause that I believe what I believe. But the claim here is that belief, hope, charity, these are supernatural gifts. They're not sociologically or psychologically explainable. So that to have that infusion of grace is then to be elevated to in some way be superhuman. Okay? Now, if we just think of it maybe in our ordinary lives, you know, you sort of look in the mirror and I'm not feeling superhuman. I don't really think I'm looking superhuman today. But what you have to maybe think of is how those graces were activated, for example, in the martyrs of the early church, where embracing the Christian faith meant, you know, possibly the loss of your life. You have to think of maybe people like St. Damien de Voyster, where, you know, he gives his life to care for lepers in the colony of leper colony of Molokai, that he would do that to the point where he comes before them one day and says, "We lepers," that he does it to the point that he contracts leprosy himself. That you would be able to be, let's say, an Immacolae Ilagabiza, that you'd be trapped in a bathroom during a genocide in Rwanda for 3 months with 7 other women living on scraps of food, and at the end of that ordeal, find out that your Hutu neighbors 2 blocks up the street hacked up your family with machetes. And that, I mean, that's all amazing as it is. But then after all that, you would be able to look these people in the eyes and forgive them for murdering your family. To forgive them and mean it. That is a supernatural power. That is not you on your own steam. That's not you because you're just, you can't hold on to grudges. You just got to be able to let them go. Somebody hacks up your family. Can't just let it make you bitter. No, you have some kind of supernatural power that's allowing that to happen. So it could be in a lot of ordinary life that you don't sort of feel like a new creation, that it may not feel like it's actually happening. But to cooperate with those graces is to have great things happening within you that, in fact, you may be unaware of. And it could be there's some moment, there's some time of crisis when those graces are called upon and they make themselves evident. But when they do, it's because of this elevation of your life that has happened supernaturally. It isn't just, this is sort of humanity at its best, you know, again, on its own steam. It's this elevation of human life that you would be able to love God and you would be able to love your neighbor in a way that is just flat out not humanly possible. That is just flat out not humanly possible. And I just think, just in conclusion, I just think if I were to, you know, kind of zero in on one thing that I know with when I teach this, especially junior year, because that's when we focus on the Christian life and things that are distinctive about the Christian life. The one thing that I want students to walk away with is that this life is a supernatural life, because their tendency walking in is to think that being Christian is being a nice person. That's what being Christian's about. It's about being nice. And sometimes even their standard for being nice is pretty low. It's like, don't be a jerk. Christ did not die on the cross and pour out his blood so that you could not be a jerk. This is all about an elevation of you. So not just that you would be able to be like kind and friendly, not just like on a pagan level. Now, this is a higher level, that you would be brave and just and temperate, but that you would be able to love God in a way that you would hand over your life to Him, that you would open your will and surrender yourself to divine providence, that you would be able to forgive any offense and any injury, that you would be able to bless those who persecute. You sound familiar? That you would be able, in other words, to do these things that are talked about in the Sermon on the Mount. If you read that Sermon on the Mount and you take it seriously, none of that stuff is naturally possible. That is because you are being called to the supernatural life. So I want students to understand, you are not just being called to a life of Minnesota niceness. You're being called to a life of picking up your cross and following the Master. And that His yoke is easy and His burden is light. And that this is all about. Not only that somehow you'd be united to God in heaven, but then in some way the beginnings of that beatitude would be in your life now. That in some way, as much as is possible in cooperation with grace, that you would live a life in union with God. This isn't just something that happens after you die. Right? As Lewis says, the blessed will be able to say in some way that they were here all along. And the damned will be able to say in some way their damnation began in the world, the choices they made. In some way we have been here all along. Go ahead, Donna. Give me a cough.
Pull back from the fire because the fire was just so hot and burned. And when they went into the church to assess the damage, everything was
incinerated.
Incinerated, except for the Bibles, which were untouched in a cross.
Very good. See you next week. Stay warm.